Welcome to another episode of Leaders Talk. My guest today is the president of CBSD, Anna Kirin.
So there's a lot of talk in Russia about how do you show your pro-peace position during these presidential elections, because all of the candidates are, they're not demonstrating any pro-peace position. So what do you do?
Leaders Talk, the interview podcast portraying leaders who are committed to better leadership, better organizations, and a better world. Hosted by managing partner of Leadership Choices and co-founder of the Cosmic Foundation, Carsten Rath.
Anna Kirin has been on this podcast before, a year ago. She's president of a leadership development company in Moscow. And a year ago, she told us about her story and her position regarding the war. And a year later, I checked in with her to see how is life changing in Russia, in Moscow. Can you speak to your friends? What is the mainstream media communicating? Expression of speech, what has happened there? And the interview has been recorded a day after the announcement of the death of Alexei Navalny, and that has obviously had an effect on the entire interview and the entire conversation. So let's go right into the interview with Anna Kirin. A warm welcome to Anna Kirin. Welcome back to Leaders Talk.
Well, nice to see you, Carsten.
Not many guests have been here twice, but Anna, there are special circumstances. Not only is your story a very fascinating one, we talked about a year ago about your role. You're president of a company in Moscow called CBSD, and you actually grew up in the United States, but you're Russian origin. And then with 19 years, you came back to Russia and have been there kind of ever since. That's and good. First of all, Anna, how are you?
You know, today is, I'm still reeling from the tragic news of yesterday. It was a shocking news, and I literally cried half the night. Now the tragic news of Alexei Navalny died in prison, and I think for so many people that it's a personal loss, because for many of us, you know that he's there. You know that Navalny has spent the last 3 years in prison, and he never bent. You know, he was always cheerful. He was always full of hope, and he's a young man. So he was 47 years old. By coincidence, the same age that Putin was when he came to power. And, he has a beautiful wife who supported him throughout his political career. And for those who don't know about him, I think it's worth telling a little bit of his story right now. He is the leader of Russian opposition. And it's even hard to say he was the leader of the Russian opposition. And he was poisoned by, it's proven, he did an investigation where he actually talked to the people who tried to kill him. He almost died. He spent 6 months rehabilitating in a clinic in Germany. And once he got better, he said, I'm going back to Russia. And he knew how dangerous it was. And his last sentence was for 19 years. And out of the 3 years that he spent in prison, 300 days he spent in isolation and really just torturous conditions. And it's, you know, and when you think about his heroic courage, you know, and the fact how stoic he was, even during his sentence, you know, you're like, well, if he's there, if he's that brave, even if I'm a tiny fraction as brave as he is, you know, life, it's okay. You know, there is hope. Yesterday, again, dozens of people were arrested because they came to lay flowers to different places around Russia, just like they did around the world. They, you know, there was a Solovetsky Rock in Moscow, which is a memorial to those who became victims of political repressions. And people, there was a line of people, you know, a crowd who came to lay flowers to that rock. And police was telling them that, you know, this is an unauthorized meeting and please leave. And people were actually, some people were arrested. So it's, it's kind of, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of hope is gone together with this incredible human being that was Alexei Navalny. Mm-hmm. And it's, I know that he's just of many victims of this regime. But it's really hard it's, as I said, it's a personal loss for many Russians around the world.
Hard to grasp, and a figure of hope gone. So what is left to give hope? So if you maybe we take a step back. Anna, and if I'm a normal citizen in Moscow these days, can you walk us through how would my life look different, like from a year ago, when I go into a shop, when I talk to people? What has changed since last year when we last spoke?
You know, in the shops, except serious inflation. Not much has changed. You can see the automotive market has changed. You know, there are Chinese cars everywhere. but I think people are generally just a lot. There's a lot more aggression. I can't say the mood of the average person has changed, but I don't know if I'm reflecting my own personal state, but it just feels like people are more tired. You know, people are tired of just eternally bad news. And watching every day on TV, I don't know if it depends on which side of the conflict you're on. I don't think it does, because if you're watching every day and on a daily basis, you're receiving information: so many killed, so many wounded, you know, explosion here, explosion there. Whether it's going on on the Ukrainian soil or on Russian soil is just, I think it cannot not affect your psyche when you are constantly witnessing death. And it's, you know, and I think you can feel it. You can feel it. And for example, there have been, you know, some of the people that are coming back from the war but people who are coming back, they're only wounded, you know. And they act, you know, they're coming back with PTSD, you know, that they have been witnesses to death and murder and a lot of violence, and so and they feel like they can continue to be violent, and you can't say anything to him. There have been cases where, you know, an owner of a bar, his business was closed because he wouldn't let a drunk, violent veteran from this war come into the bar, and then his bar was closed down. So you know, I was sitting at the movies with my youngest daughter, who's 15, and this guy comes in. He has two bottles of vodka in both hands, you know, and he is wearing his military uniform, and he's swearing, you know, very loud, very inappropriate, drunken behavior with a lot of swear words, and nobody would say anything to him because you would offend a veteran. And I think people are beginning to feel that there is violence around them, and they're naturally tired of it. And there have been some studies that show that people are tired of war and they want the war to be over. And of course, in today's Russia, you cannot demonstrate your peaceful views at all, at all. There's criminal prosecution that for expressing views against war, with a lot, large prison sentences, and there are several hundred people right now in prison for things like there was a famous case when a 9-year-old girl, she drew a picture in school where there was like a Ukrainian flag and you know, so like a Russian with some kind, you know, some kind of an anti-war picture. Mm-hmm. And her father is in prison now. And the 9-year-old girl is living, you know, she lost the person who she grew up with because her mother, you know, she was living, live separately from them. So it's, and there are a lot of cases like that, or Sasha, I forgot her last name, I'll look it up, but you know, you have to know names of people like that, who is now serving a very large prison sentence for replacing price tags in a supermarket with like no to war signs. So, but there's still something like, we want this to be over. People are tired. For example, there is a movement of the wives of mobilized men who are, they are not saying anything politically aggressive. You know, they're saying, we have nothing against the regime. We just want our men back because they have been mobilized more than a year ago. And there is no transparency as to when they'll be back. And, you know, it's a stance that the authorities don't know what to do with, because these are the women of men who are armed. And it's, you know, they have some, like every Sunday in Moscow, they come to a memorial of unknown soldier for World War II. And they come and they wear white scarves. And nobody can do anything about them. So they will arrest journalists who are covering the story, but they won't arrest the women because they don't. What for? They're not discrediting army. They're not. They just want their men back. And there is a lot of unfairness because some people. Some soldiers were recruited from prison. I don't know if you know about that, which was the Prigozhin's private army. They recruited men from prison. So people who were serving sentences for some of them for really atrocious crimes like murder and rape and were given amnesty to go fight on the Ukrainian soil. And these men are served like 6 months and they're back to their hometowns and really peaceful men who were mobilized. They're still fighting. So these wives of mobilized men, it's very difficult what are you going to do about them? So the authorities just don't speak about them. You won't hear about them on the news except like on unofficial like YouTube channels and Telegram channels, but Putin doesn't mention them. And by the way, nothing on the official television channels about Navalny today. Nothing. Yeah, the whole world, it's front page news, headlines, President of the United States addresses the public and leaders and heads of states all over the world are talking about Alexei Navalny's death. Nothing on the news in Russia. It's amazing. And it just feels like, you know, it's it's more like a conflict of generations, because a lot of people who are in the position of power in Russia now, they are in their 70s. And a lot of Soviet methods are closer to them. Like yesterday on the news, before even we were watching the news, and this somebody in the State Duma was saying, "Okay, now we see that a lot of young people are on the internet and they're not reading printed newspapers." So we have to pass the law to print more newspapers so that they will read more newspapers and leave the internet. When they say something like that, you get a feeling that they have no understanding of how the younger generation lives, and they think that they can regulate progress. Well, they can't. And it's even generational, I think.
And Anna, what do you need? Maybe explain to us. So if I'm not politically interested and just watch the official television, the official media, I get one side of the story, which is, you know, Alexei Navalny not even mentioned. But how much effort do you need to take in order to make sure that you get accurate information?
Fortunately, we have, you know, there's a lot of Telegram channels, a lot of YouTube channels of media that is independent, and a lot of people who have left Russia. They are producing news channels abroad, and for the time being, we still have access to the World Wide Web. So it's okay. The problem is that your average person living outside of a big cities, he's not gonna even know what to look for, you know. Because some names don't mean anything to them, and they don't even know that they need to make the effort, and so that they only have access to what's readily available, and they don't even know how different that point of view is from what you can hear globally. And you know, a lot of what Putin has mentioned in his interview, you know, it's like everything he said, that's what he repeats to the Russian public. I mean, we could answer questions in the Tucker Carlson interview instead of Putin. We know exactly what he would say, you know. Historically, Great Russia, you know, Ukraine is non-existent, and he makes like historical references which are sometimes inaccurate, but sometimes they're accurate but not applicable, and it's and just irrelevant. But we know, and then the West, you know, and the spread of NATO, you know, we could, his rhetoric we know by heart, That's actually the reason why I wouldn't watch like several hours worth of that same story that we hear him speak about. You know, he continuously complains about the West, you know, on the attack of Russia, and there are a lot of people in the West who repeat that as well. You know, it's like the diplomacy has failed, but that doesn't take away again who Putin is.
And there are two elections that is like oil into the fire, right? There's the presidential election in Russia, and there is the presidential election in the US,
right?
And this sounds like almost like an extension of the war into, you know, the polarity between Democrats and Republicans, where kind of the voting power is kind of used to block funding for artillery ammunition for Ukraine. Is that all transparent to people in Moscow if they want to get to know it, or in Russia?
The U.S. elections are covered In a very lopsided manner, you know, like somebody who is critiquing Biden or Democrats, you know, and they will only quote those journalists and saying, yes, even American journalists are make fun of Biden and how senile he is, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's funny because sometimes you like you sit next to this person. It's like, yeah, because they can. And they can actually critique their president. And yes, of course, it's very much to advantage of the Russian armed position in Ukraine that the political chaos going on in the United States. Because we can see that Ukrainian aid is blocked, and I think next approach to it is going to be only in March. Just yesterday, Ukrainian armed forces declared that they're leaving Avdiivka, which is a town that they've been very, very casualty rich battles around for several months. So the Ukrainian forces are leaving Avdiivka in order to avoid further casualties. And you can see that the Ukrainian military position is obviously not very strong, and we understand that part of the news that we can see on federal channels is it reflects the position of the armed forces of the two countries, and yeah, I mean that the Ukrainian position is weakened by what's going on globally.
And here is a note on our own behalf. We have been talking about the Cosmic Foundation every now and then, but the interview with Anna just kind of triggered me to bring this up again. No, start again. And here is a note on our own behalf. The Cosmic Foundation supports NGOs in the Ukraine by enabling them free access to high-quality coaching. The organization we are working with is called Foundation for the Future of Ukraine, and they work in the field of providing prosthetics for soldiers wounded in the war, for women who had to endure sexual violence, and for kids with mental health issues. They are highly professional. We have met the organization. We started working with the different representatives of the organization. We are very, very impressed by their quality, by their rigorousness, by their transparency to really bring future and hope back to Ukraine. I also recorded a podcast with Elena Nikolayenko a couple of weeks back, and that is definitely worth listening. But we need support for our foundation. So if you want to support our cause, then simply go to www.cosmic, that's COSMICK, -foundation.org, and you will find the donate button on the upper right corner, and we are happy for all kind of donations that is required to pay the coaches so that they can do their important work, and we can support them over several years, since this is the approach that we are taking to support one or two organizations over several years so that we have a real impact. So thanks for all of your support. And now back to the interview with Anna Kirin. And Anna, maybe back also to your, I mean, the private life, your circle of friends or people that you meet or people in the business world, do you observe any changes in behavior given the laws, the legal situation, or once you're in a friendship circle, it's kind of safe?
Well, I can certainly tell you that I would be a lot more careful with people who I don't know well about what I say and how I say it. I still talk about the conflict in Russia, but just trying to discuss the objective piece of it, you know, in it is, you know, we were sitting in a restaurant with our management team from CBSD, and I think I was saying something like rather loudly at the table, and you know, yeah, because so those conversations, they are very very open conversations with people you don't know. We avoid them, all of us, all Russians. I think I have been very, very lucky in the sense that all of my family members and my very close friends and a lot of my colleagues feel the same way that I do. And I know that. And I think I'm very lucky because I know that many families and many friendships have been broken by, because people hold opposing views. And a lot of people in Russia, you know, feel that, yes, you know, we were under attack from the West. You know, we had to defend our sovereignty.
So the rhetoric kind of worked somehow.
Well, you have to understand that Putin's rhetoric is, he manages to manipulate things that are almost sacred to Russians. You know, for every single family, I think, had a relative who fought in World War II. You know, the whole World War II thing is just sacred. You know, we won in a war that basically threatened, you know, it was existential war for Russia. It threatened its existence. And the rhetoric that he is using, you know, Ukraine is ruled by Nazis. You know, the West once again wanted for Russia to lose its sovereignty. It hits home to a lot of people. There is no reason not to believe him. You know, and he will use certain facts that are objective, and he will say, well, you see, this is proof that I'm telling you the truth, and I am literally fighting another existential war. What is there, you know, that people can just get a hold of that is going to tell them something different? I don't, you know, I don't know. And for a lot of people, like you said, like, does it affect people on the, you know, just on the street? Especially if you're living in a small town in the regions and you have never had, listen, people there, the average, you know, maximum they can earn is like 20,000 rubles a month, which is nowadays an equivalent of $200 or 200 euros, let's say. And they could never afford to travel abroad or buy expensive cars they were living a really poor life. Nothing has changed for them, except maybe that if you're a young man, you can go and earn 10 times as much, $2,000 a month of fighting in a war. you can spend that money to support your families, you know, buy an apartment even, you know, because there are really low interest mortgages available to them. And it's not a situation where people are asking themselves questions. We're murdering people. You know, there are boys dying on both sides. You know, and right now, nobody knows exactly, but the casualty count is close to 1 million by some estimates. If we take both sides, plus about 1 million young men left Russia. Yeah, this is like real hit to the population. But until something hits your home and your family, that those are not the questions that you're going to torture yourself with, because they are torturous. And literally, you know, if I know that in Ukraine, you know, there are a lot of, you know, men dying who are well educated, and in Russia, probably the ones who are fighting in the war are probably in a lesser economic and social status. We have casualties, immigration casualties, you know, where literally the most educated, the most enlightened men, young men who are, you know, left the country. And so what are you doing to the genetic pool? You know? It's tragic. It's tragic. And I think when a tragedy on this scale is happening all around you, it's going to affect you one way or another, whether you think about it, whether you're taking a side or not, because people want to block it. But tragedy affects everyone when it's this massive, one way or another, even if it's...
And then you want to close down. You want to have a simple answer, simple life. Don't make up your mind every time what is right, what is wrong. Can I believe this? Yes or no? That's all very energy consuming, right? So simplicity is something that I can imagine that many people look for a simple answer. And then there's the presidential elections. And there was another element of hope. Anna, you told me about that earlier. So what has happened there?
Well, we had suddenly at the end of last year, one of very minor Russian politicians, but he is a career politician, but he was on a very regional scale, and he has announced that he will run for the presidential post, and he announced a very clear position that bears no two interpretations. The war in Ukraine needs to be stopped, and we need to change Putin's regime. We need to make Russia attractive to all its citizens and free political prisoners. And very unequivocal. And his last name is Nadezhdin, which Nadezhda is hope. So it's a very, it's a very telling last name. And people didn't know who he was, literally. It was the first time I heard about him, you know. And I think I'm pretty literate as far as acting politicians are concerned. And it was like, wow. How is he not afraid? Is he, well, they're not going to give him a chance. And so in order to run for presidential post, unless you're an acting member of Duma, you have to demonstrate and prove that you will be supported by at least by at least a portion of a population. So you have to bring, well, in his case, it was 100,000 signatures of supporters, and it was amazing to see that. Oh, and he had like less than a month to do it. So you have like he had until January, and then you have the New Year's holidays, which are very lengthy in Russia. You know, people go to work like on the 12th, and there is the New Year's vacation, and then he had like 3 weeks basically to collect the signatures, and everybody was like, no. No, he's not going to be able to do it because it takes a lot of money and he doesn't have sponsors. And he announced that he will not take any sponsorship money, that he will crowdfund. And then, first of all, he was successful gathering the financial support that he needs just from crowdfunding. And then word of mouth. And people lined up in freezing temperatures. It was like minus 20 degrees Celsius outside, and people were standing for hours in lines to sign their support, and they were not afraid. And it was like a protest meeting, and it was just wonderful to watch. I actually went and I stood in this line for a little while because it was just, you know, it was a way for people to show, you know, it was a way for us all to see that you're not alone, that there are a lot of people who with the same feelings that you have. And so around the country, actually, people lined up. And it's funny because Putin said that he collected 3 million signatures and nobody saw lines anywhere for Putin. You know, and you have like a shopping center where they set up booths to collect signatures, and there's like a booth for Putin and a booth for Nadezhdin. There's a line for Nadezhdin and an empty booth for Putin. And so it was like, it's like, okay, did he really collect 3 million signatures? People are beginning to ask these questions. Well, anyway, but... The Federal Election Committee, then they have to, you bring in these boxes and boxes and boxes of papers with signatures on them. You bring them there and then they examine them. And they need to verify that such a person exists and et cetera, et cetera. So they, and Nadezhdin, He needed to collect like 100,000 signatures, and he collected 200,000 only in Russia and about as much abroad. So this you could just see how explosive his candidacy was, that people actually, you know, his clear mandate, what people wanted to support that. So anyway, but the Federal Election Committee then declared that out of the selection of signatures that they had a chance to examine, about 30% were defective. Either these people were non-existent, or there was no such street name, the address is incorrect. So they weren't able to verify about 30% of the signatures, and they refused to register his candidacy. So that's another thing that happened since we talked last. And that's a pity. There is now so a lot of people who want to vote for peace, or for a candidate, a pro-peace candidate, they now don't have a candidate. So there is a lot of talk in Russia about how do you show your pro-peace position during these presidential elections, because all of the candidates are, there is a communist, there is a... another candidate, but they're all show, they're not demonstrating any pro-peace position. So what do you do? And there is an idea that the election is going to be 3 days, that on March 17th, which is the third day of the election, exactly at noon, come to vote exactly at noon on the third day of the election, and then vote for whoever you want to. But it's going to be a way for you to demonstrate your position, because there is no other legal way to demonstrate your position. So it's a chance for large crowds to gather with a specific position in mind, which they can't declare in any other legal way.
Okay. So if I summarize what I learned from you, streamlined official media reporting one side of the story and one side only, growing oppression with regards to regular expressions of thoughts, Navalny dead, Najestian being declined for formalities. What gives you hope?
I think we are we have to deal with a lot of helplessness. But again, to quote Navalny, he said, "I am not afraid, and you don't be afraid." The worst thing that you can do is what's the word? Отчаяние. When you lose all hope. So just continue to do what you do. I think I'm very lucky that I work in the world of people development, it's a wonderful field to be in. And I for one, I still get to do what I love. As many of the professions in Russia are becoming, more and more difficult to be in. Journalism, teachers who work with kids. You have to be very careful about how you teach history now, or literature, and writers. Any profession in culture, theater. I don't know if the world heard about this. In December there was like a New Year's party or something where a lot of really big Russian stars all came, and it was like a semi-naked party. You have to come with a little clothes on as you could. So people came in bikinis and whatever. Now somebody wrote to police complaining that this is offensive. And literally, all the star and all the big names who were at that party, they're literally forbidden from giving concerts or being on TV now. So it's not even political repression; it's repression of human rights of expression. You can not only. It seems as if they want to make expression of personality and any personal freedoms to make it as difficult as possible.
It feels desperate, right? It feels like they are somewhat desperately trying to defend their position of power with more. I mean, it sounds like more and more absurdity in order to.
It's just some of the things, they just seem now exactly as you said, absurd. That they make less and less sense. But it's not only him. You know, he's at the. It's not only Putin who is trying to hold on to his power, but everyone around him, and it cascades. So there are a lot of people who are afraid, who are in the position of any sort of power, any amount of power, or any money-making abilities. If you're in business, you know, and it's all interdependent. So it becomes really a very literal fight for your own earnings and position at all levels. So it's not necessarily Putin ordering a repression of pop stars who attended a semi-naked party, but somebody is like, oh, you know, I'm afraid I'll lose my position if I don't respond to this complaint of offense. And it becomes it's a lot of self-editing, and a lot of initiative, and very local levels.
So it's
and
an
that's
entire,
how repressions work anywhere.
Yeah.
You know.
So it's an entire system kind of supporting this, trying to protect their stakes, their power. Because probably there's also a feeling once change comes, it's not going to be gradual. It's be disruptive in one way, shape, or form. And I think that I somehow you also sense, when I listen to you, I also sense fear, right? On the side of the people in power.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you do. I think, you know, fear is a very basic instinct, and you're absolutely right. If the regime changes, what's going to happen to me? You know, it's a very on a physical level, a very basic self-protection. So it replicates itself. It reproduces. That's why it's so difficult to imagine change. But look, you know, history, you know, has shown. Soviet Union at one point seemed, indestructible, and it fell apart in weeks. And if you remember 1991, if you remember the news pictures from Moscow, the streets were flooded with people who wanted change. So is there a need that people demonstrate for change? Well, you know, Nadezhdin's story and candidacy demonstrate that there is certainly a need, that people are tired. People are tired to be afraid. People are tired of aggression and violence around them. People want more peaceful news, basically. You know, people are tired. You know, and even if you don't see the realities of war every day in Russia, what you do see from every screen is that you are in isolation. You are no longer part of a global story. And, you know, you have strange friends, which we have never been friends with, like China and North Korea and African nations. You know, it's like guy. And Russians, basically, they've always felt themselves to be European. So it's just like, what happened to the world that we knew? And whether it's subconscious, and for some people it's subconscious, but you know, people want to be happy, first of all. They don't want to be at constant war with the world. And that's what you hear from every screen. The world is against Russia. The world is our enemy, and that's you know, you get tired of that. You don't want to be at war with the world for years and years and years. I guess we all live here. Even people who want to support Putin in his defense of Mother Russia, but you do want, you know, you do want friends, basically. Yeah. And it's and I think subconsciously, even if you feel you're in constant danger and Russia is under constant attack and Russia's president is doing all he can to protect your country, even so, you would be tired of being under constant attack. So if people will see that there is a hope for change of that, I think there will be mass support.
And Anna, you talking to me, recording this, that's a risk for you. Why do you do it?
I think it's important that the world knows that Russia is not a lost nation, that it's full of people who maybe sometimes don't know or don't want to know the truth, but it's full of people who just want to be happy and who are living in conditions which are becoming more and more difficult every day. And I also think it's important to know that the situation, that if you don't hear a lot from the Russians opposing the war, if you don't see demonstrations on the streets, if you don't see people calling for change, the world needs to understand there's a very good reason for that. People are afraid for their lives, and people are literally dying in prisons. And so we're hoping for maybe, you know, for transformation, and then maybe the world can say, well, why don't you do something about it? Well, meetings don't no longer work in Russia, so it has to be some kind of a process. And I like to Nadezhdin's long term plan. He's like, okay, obviously I'm not going to be president during this election, but he's planning for change on local levels, maybe, you know, regional legislative bodies there will come more and more candidates who want to change the current policy, you know, foreign and not so foreign on the territory of Russia, because there is a war going on in Russia right now as well. You know, it's a civil war that's, I think, already in progress. Your population is divided, and divided on a very physical level, you know.
Thank you, Anna, for taking us into the different aspects of life today in Russia. To end on a positive note, what's one thing that you're looking forward to despite everything else?
My trip to the US in May, where I'm going to get to see my oldest daughter. It's still every time I travel outside of Russia, you know, it's funny, you know, actually that's when you can see the change, because when you're sitting here, it's, you know, the gradual change you don't see as much, but once you like go and visit a Western country, you're gonna go, oh, okay, this is what it's supposed to be like. So every trip outside of Russia is kind of it's very, very good for the soul.
Well, I hope that soon you will not need those trips anymore to refresh the soul, that something will refresh the soul also in Russia. But I must say, I also don't know where this is coming from, but somehow something must come. That's my hope, I would say. And Anna, let's keep talking. Thank you for being a voice here and for speaking up. And let's keep talking, and see you next time.
Yes, yes, Kars. I would love that.
So that was Anna Kirin. What are your thoughts, reflections? Please send us an email at leaderstalk@leadership-choices.com or leave us a review, some comments. We'll be answering all mails, all messages from you for sure. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, and see you again soon in 2 weeks' time here at Leaders Talk. Bye for now.